We work with clients, one of the things you really want to understand is how much are you willing to contribute towards your property portfolio on an annual basis? And the reason for that is because a lot of the properties we're buying in the current environment, I'd say 99%, are cash flow negative because of the high interest rates and also some of these higher costs that we've spoken about with insurance as well. But interest rates is the primary driver.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to Dashdot Insider, the auditory epicenter for passionate property investors seeking a life of freedom, choice, and abundance. I'm your host, Emil Pender, and joining me today, our head of client success at Dashdot, Jason De Silva. How's it going, Jason?
I'm awesome, Emil. How are you going?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Last week, we were privileged enough to have a long chat with Jason where we investigated six key factors that we feel are going to create upward pressure on the property market. We're going to see a lot of equity growth. In this episode, we are going to investigate a bunch of other factors. We're really going to steel man that argument that we made last week. We're going to see if these other three, four, five factors that we've been looking at, a lot of people think that these are actually going to have a negative effect on the property market, right? A lot of people sort of worried about this, worried about that. We really want to investigate those, find out the truth, see if there may well be some negative impact that we need to be thinking about and we need to be accounting for, we need to have contingencies for when people are getting into the property market. And we're probably going to find that a couple of beliefs, strongly held beliefs that people have around natural disasters and things like that and how they might affect the property market may not actually be true. So, Jason, ripping into it, the very first one of these that we have, the cost of living crisis that could well slow down the property market. What have we discovered on this topic?
So what we're going to be looking at is the cost of living. So that, to start with the definition. So that's defined as the amount of money needed to cover basic expenses such as food and housing in a specific location. So we've got a really interesting stat here. So in 2024, a family of four's estimated monthly cost stands at $9,087 compared to $7,832 in 2022. So in 2024, the average cost needed for a family of four was about $9,000. And now we're seeing that compared to in 2022, where it was $7,832. So pretty substantial increase just in basic expenses for a house to survive.
That's gone up by more than $1,200. Out of $7,800, that's like an increase of about 18%, something like that, right? It's more than a sixth and less than a fifth. So it's probably around about 18%, something like that. Now that's 18%. That's an extra $1,200. That's after tax income.
Correct.
That $1,200 is after tax, and that is if you're making the $9,000 a month. To be clearing $9,000 a month, you're in that top tax bracket, right? So effectively, your salary needs to have gone up by maybe $2,000 a month, something like that, right? If you didn't get a raise of 20 grand over the course of the last 2 years, then you're really, really feeling the pinch.
100%. And this is looking at the current inflation rate as of December at 4.1. So that's an increase of 4.1 with inflation, but the increase in household expenditure is significantly more than that over the 2 year period.
Okay. This is a very interesting topic. You know that this is one of my favorite things to dig into, and that is monetary expansion. I think I accidentally mentioned this on just about every episode that I participate in or host. So I've talked way too much about it already. We're not going to dig too far down into that same rabbit hole today, but I did do a little bit of a checking before we jumped on today. And the amount of money that was added to the system over the course of the last year, they say that there's an annual inflation rate of 4.1%. But if you look at how much money was actually added into the Australian economy, you have different levels of money, and they're categorized M0, M1, M2, M3, blah, blah, blah. And M0 is just cash that people have. And then M1 includes deposits in banks and a few other things. By the time you get to M3, that's all basically like pretty much all of the money. It's your big institutional investors. It's your financial product. It's everything. That's all of the money. When we look at the M3, how much that has gone up in the course of the last year, it's between $200 and $250 billion, right? It's about $20 billion per month. The total amount of M3 is about $3 trillion. So that means that the $20 billion over 3 trillion is about 0.2%. It's about 0.67% per month. Per year, that means that it's 8%, right? Because 12 times 2/3 is 8. So it's 8%. So they say 4.1%, but the amount that the monetary supply has expanded, so the amount that money has actually inflated, is 8%. So I don't know where, I mean, the calculation for the official current inflation rate is always a little bit, it's a little bit like the Australian Bureau of Statistics. They try to track various things, but it always feels like it's a little bit of an imprecise measure, and it doesn't reflect the true amount of money that's being added to the system, and the true amount of money being added to the system, that 8%, is much more useful for trying to understand how much cost of living is going to go up. Now, if it's just at 8% and it's produced somewhere between an 18 and a 20% increase in living costs for a family of four, I can't see that changing over the course of the next year. I think we're still going to see that monetary expansion continue to happen. And so the living crisis, the cost of living crisis, I think will continue. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, for sure, right? Especially when we're looking at investors specifically, because investors are using money that's surplus. They're using savings, or they're using equity or capital they've generated and saved for a long period of time to invest. And when there's increased cost of living, it's going to affect their ability to do that, because more of that money is being used to just generally survive. And you just spoke about those increases nowhere near matching what the current wage increases are. So there is definitely a deficit there that's going to impact investors and their sentiment. There are still ways to move forward in that current environment, but looking at your savings and like your basic, that's one of the most basic hierarchy of needs. You look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, safety and security, that's definitely going to outweigh any intention of investing if that's being challenged, right? So I think it's definitely going to impact investors' sentiment in terms of looking at whether they can still participate in the market. Because when we're looking at even the way that borrowing capacity is calculated, it's calculated looking at expenses, income minus expenses and what's left over. If those expenses keep increasing, the surplus is going to be reduced, which could potentially impact investors' ability to borrow as well.
Okay, so this is definitely a factor that we could see pull the market back just a little bit, or at least slow its growth. However, a counter argument to that, what I'm thinking is if we're adding all of this additional money, if we're inflating the money supply by 8% per year, I can't see that changing. The government is going to continue to want more and more money pumped into the system, because normally that's done through banks, and then the banks can buy bank loans. Can buy bonds off the government. To give you an idea of how much money that is, right? Because talking about big numbers, 3 trillion, 20 billion, that sort of thing, that total amount of sort of $240 billion per year that is being added to the economy, all of the tax revenue that the Australian government gets each year is between $650 and $700 billion. And we're talking about adding $240 billion to the economy each year. So it's more than a third of all of the tax revenue. That's how much extra cash goes into the system. And it doesn't go into the system uniformly. Not all goods increase. Some things like where that money goes increase by more, and more of that money goes into the property market. So I sort of see two things happening. First, all of that money is making it more expensive for people to live. Prices are inflating, but salaries aren't going up as much. The second thing that's happening is it's pushing the property prices up as well. So getting in as soon as possible feels like it might be the smart move, because the properties are going to be moving and borrowing capacity is going to start going down. And we might well enter a phase where, you know, if you're not getting into a property over the course of the next 12, 18, 24 months, it's going to get a lot harder. It's going to get way, way harder.
Yeah, 100%, especially in the lower price point bracket. So we're seeing this in the property prices from sub 500,000, where the lower that you go from that 500,000, the harder the market heat is and amount of people looking to participate in the market. We had a property that one of our team were looking at for a client, and in the span of a few hours, the property had 34 offers on it. And it was a property in that sub $500,000 range. So because of the cost of living increases, it's affecting how much someone can borrow, which means they can only borrow potentially, it depends on that, everyone's different, but they can definitely borrow less than they were able to maybe a few years ago. And as a result, they're trying to participate in this lower price bracket, which is where everyone is, because the cost of living crisis is affecting most people. It's creating a significant uptick in demand for those lower priced assets, which is creating a bit of a bit of a reverse effect in terms of property prices as well.
Okay. So we're seeing property prices across the board going up. We're also seeing it harder for people to purchase those properties. So at some point, we would expect the property increases or the rate of growth to start slowing down to some degree.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's quite an unsustainable moment at the at the moment. We've got 34 offers on a property. A property selling hundreds and thousands of dollars over what they're advertised for. It's a pretty crazy environment to be in. And when that starts to slow down, I don't know, because we're seeing so much short, like what we spoke about in the last podcast, was we're seeing significant declines in building approval rates. There's not enough houses being created to meet the demand of people coming in, right? So it looks like, obviously, it is a bit of an unsustainable period of growth at the moment, but that is likely to continue in the current environment because we don't have enough supply to meet the amount of people that want to participate in the market. But you've also got this alternative effect of cost of living that is there, and it's affecting people's ability to participate in the market as well. So it's a bit of a twofold issue.
And importantly as well, people who are already property investors, they're seeing their properties continue to go up and up and up. And they're thinking, well, I've got all of this equity sitting in that property now. Well, I can do something. I can leverage that and I can get into the next one. Whereas somebody else trying to save their way into their first property, those are the people getting hit hardest.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
All right. So it really does, if anything, we can impress upon people the need to get in fairly soon because it's just going to get harder and harder and harder. I can't see the monetary supply. I can't see inflation slowing down anytime soon. On that topic, the government have been putting out messaging. Well, the government, the media, whether or not the government's tapped them on the shoulder or not, there does seem to be a reasonable amount of messaging that interest rates are likely to come down towards the end of the year, right? Because, you know, we're going to have a handle on inflation by then. I can't see that happening, right? I'm not an economist, just a property investor, but I can't really see that happening towards the end of the year. Like, oh yeah, inflation's going to be under control. You know, we're going to be addressing cost of living crisis, blah, blah, blah. I just can't see that happening. I think the government still needs money and they need to be issuing bonds. Banks still need to be writing loans. We're seeing them relaxing lending criteria and things like that. All of these things that are very inflationary, and the only thing that is not inflationary is reducing the interest rates, but I think that's going to have an inflationary effect as well. All right, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. The other thing, the next thing that we wanted to cover today, and it's something that pops up in the media a lot these days, and that is the rise of crypto. I think it's a fairly complex topic, crypto and its impact on the Aussie property market.
100%. I know you're a crypto fiend yourself, Emil. So what downward effects do you see with crypto affecting the property market?
To be honest, I can't see a lot of downward effects, not a lot of negative effects for the Australian property market right at the moment. I can't really see them happening for quite a while. And the reason for that is, like, what is crypto really? There are two ways of looking at it. One is as a highly speculative investment. At the moment, there is such small, in relative terms, there's such small adoption of crypto. The market cap for all of the crypto, it's like, it's under $2 trillion, right? Compared to gold, which is like up at 10 or something like that. So there isn't even as much in crypto as there is in gold. Now, with all of these kinds of assets, when people are looking at them as investments, gold's a great example because you have like its utility value, what you can use gold for, teeth, jewelry, semiconductors. But then you also have its value as a store of wealth. And once people start thinking of it in that way, once people think of crypto in that way, then it might start to take some of that market cap away from gold. And a lot of the hodlers, we would say hodlers, the people who hold on for dear life, they don't sell when the market goes up or down or anything like that, they just hold forever. The hodlers who believe that Bitcoin, not crypto, but specifically Bitcoin, is going to create a new utopia because it's hard money and governments can't manipulate it, blah, blah, blah. They believe that eventually Bitcoin will end up swallowing up all of that extra monetary value, all of that store of wealth out of gold, and then eventually the property market. Now, if they are right, and it's entirely plausible that they could be right, but we're talking 10, 20, I would say it'll happen in 30 years. Within 30 years, it will have happened. But now, no, I can't see it happening. In 10 years, gun to my head, I don't think I can see that happening either. At the moment, people need somewhere to put their money where they feel it's going to be safe and it's going to get them through the cost of living crisis, inflation, interest rate changes, all of this uncertainty. Property is the certain thing. Crypto certainly is not. And I've got a lot of friends and even some colleagues who have bought into crypto, normally buying when there's a lot of media hype around it, thinking, oh, yes, I can make, you know, I'll drop 20, 30, 40, 50 grand in here. And it'll double in a few months because of this article that I read. Or, you know, we're talking about people entering something that's highly volatile, that doesn't have widespread adoption, and is very, very easy to manipulate. And so, because you can have, there's not much cash in it. You can have some really big whales come in with a couple of billion dollars, and they can make the price bounce around like a frog in a sock. And in that kind of environment, a lot of people do kind of, unfortunately, make a decision that they want to try crypto, get burnt, and then get spat out the end having lost 20 or 30 grand or something like that. I can't see crypto taking anything away from the property market whatsoever. I can see crypto increasing because big institutional investors in the US are now starting to include it in their portfolios. But we're a long way from the average Australian property investor thinking, you know what, Bitcoin is a safer investment, it's more stable, and I think it's going to give me a better long-term growth potential. I think we are a decade at least away from any that thought even popping into anyone's head. So while it's in the media and people might be talking it up, sort of don't get fooled by the marketing. It's still massively volatile, that would be my message, which is not financial advice.
Yeah, 100%. Like, the main things that I see with that is that Australia, like, there's the great Australian dream, right? Being able to own your own home. Australians are very passionate about property, looking at websites like Real Estate and Domain just for fun whilst they're on their phone.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is quite interesting, right? It's a pretty cool pastime for Australians. And we've also got the main benefits of crypto I see are, like, the barrier to entry. Obviously, at buying a property, you do need to save a deposit, and that can take some time, whereas with crypto, you can invest with smaller sums of money, which could appeal to more younger investors that are trying to get into them, like trying to participate in investing or, yeah.
The casino also has a low barrier to entry. Right.
Yeah.
You're over 18, wander in, over 21, whatever it might be in different places, right? But and you can wander right in, and you can, and that's basically what crypto is at the moment, right? The amount of volatility that you see across all of the cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin was in the media because it hit a new high of whatever it was. It's been bouncing around 75, 76, and now it's popped back down to 65, right? So there's 15% gone in a week. Is that the environment that you really want to be investing in? I think also property is easy to understand. It's very, very easy to understand. It's fairly straightforward. There's a little bit of fear because it's a high ticket item, and so it can be the most expensive thing that people buy in their lives, but there's so much security around it. There are so many regulations in place to keep the property market solid. It's really, really good for property investors. With crypto, you don't have anything like that. You've got the low barrier to entry. Trying to understand crypto, we're a very, very long way away. Just from the little switch of people thinking of Bitcoin as a currency instead of an asset. We're an incredibly long way away from that. I would say crypto, basically irrelevant. The next thing, then, if we've knocked crypto over, the next thing to have a look at, I think, natural disasters. A lot of people have strong views on natural disasters that aren't necessarily based in fact or based in data. What's your sort of take on how a natural disaster can affect property prices and the property market overall?
Yeah, it's a good question. So we've got some interesting stats to go through. We can also go through some, like, common misconceptions or understandings as well. So with natural disasters, we're talking about things like floods, bushfires, etc. They can create some interesting challenges within the property market. So from a insurance perspective, when those events occur, it can drive insurance premiums up in the area. It can also create insurance embargoes, where companies won't issue new policies for properties in those areas. We've seen that come through more recently for us in Cairns a few months ago, where we were buying in two suburbs that weren't affected by any floods, but because there were floods in the general Cairns area and storms, there was an insurance embargo put in place where a lot of the new insurance companies wouldn't provide policies to anyone. And when you need an insurance certificate of currency to settle a property, it can create a challenging environment there. And it can also create consumer sentiment risks as well, because clients are looking at these assets and looking at these areas to invest in, but they've been affected by all these natural disasters. So it can create a consumer sentiment challenge for sure. I think that's the main issue primarily. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, to be clear, we didn't end up putting somebody into properties that we're okay, good.
Definitely not.
Well, yeah, I think my feeling on that is in places where there might be insurance embargoes, obviously, you don't want to be buying there. In other areas that might be more prone to natural disasters, you may well be seeing higher insurance costs, right? Because the actuaries working in the insurance companies, they need to be calculating things so that the insurance company isn't going to make a loss. And also, it's worthwhile for the individual to get the insurance so that they feel protected, right? So a fairly sensible kind of insurance environment. And so some locations in Australia are going to have higher costs, but at the same time, those higher costs normally run hand in hand with higher rental rates. And so normally, as with most things when it comes to property investing, when there are additional costs or sort of spanners get thrown in the works, it's very, very rarely the landlord who ends up bearing the brunt of it, right? Who ends up wearing the cost. It's normally the tenant. Like if the government were to come out tomorrow and say, all right, well, we need to, you know, we've got a problem with too many landlords, not enough owner-occupiers, we're now going to introduce a new tax to landlords. Landlords are just going to go, oh, okay, cool. All right, well, how much do I need to increase my rents then to make sure that's covered? And it's the tenants who are already suffering in the middle of a cost of living crisis. They're the ones that are going to suffer from it, right? They're the ones who are going to be like, oh, okay. And instead of them getting 20% of a raise over 2 years working in their job, they're just going to have to save more. They're going to have to go without. And that's just the way that system works. So looking at properties in an area where insurance premiums are a bit higher, I don't see as a negative. I think it's a negative if you can't see a compensatory increase in rents. And if you can see that, then you start looking at the growth and the cash flow, and is this the property that I need to be fitting into for my portfolio? That's my take on it. How did I do?
Yeah, I think that's the way to go, and that was a great summary. We buy in a lot of areas that have potentially higher insurance costs, specifically in North Queensland. That's a very common one, and I'm sure a lot of listeners would be across this as well, where there are not only higher insurance, but also higher rates, expenses as well. But those, most of the time, if not all the time, translate to higher rental increases, and those properties will have a higher yield as a result. So the net cash flow, when comparing to an area that doesn't have high insurance and high rates, can actually end up being pretty much the same. It's just looking at, there are still really good opportunities in these markets, so we don't want to exclude them just because the insurance is a little bit more expensive or the rates are a little bit more expensive. It's about looking at that area and then also mitigating for that risk as well. So from our side, for our clients, we're going to look at things like flood maps as part of our due diligence to make sure the property isn't flood affected. We're also going to look at getting insurance estimates to make sure that the insurance isn't $50,000 a year to get a policy, and that it will still stack up with the client's cash flow and what they're trying to achieve. So we need, those checks are really important to make sure you don't make a mistake there, and there also is really good opportunity in buying there and getting really good growth as a result. So definitely something to look at when you are purchasing a property, but there are ways to mitigate those risks to still ensure you get a good result.
Okay. And at Dashdot, we're pretty lucky because we also have Nick.
Yeah. So we have Nick, who's our property acquisition manager. He's an expert and an ex-flood engineer. So anytime there's any question marks around properties or suburbs that we're looking at, we definitely utilize his skill set to make sure we can mitigate those risks for our clients.
I think that's a really, really important point, because a lot of people might look at a flood map overlay, and think, oh, well, my property, it's not in the floodplain, so I'm okay. But there's a bit more to it than that. It's not just making sure that your place isn't going to get flooded out. It's like, okay, if there is a flood, how are insurance companies likely to react in that neighborhood or in that suburb? What could that potentially do to premiums? And making sure that you understand that before you go in and purchase in that location, because it could be a fantastic property for your portfolio. It could be a disaster. It kind of depends on whether or not you've looked at all of these variables and assessed them objectively and intelligently.
100%. Like, one other thing I was going to mention that is an important consideration as well is lending considerations. So checking to make sure that lenders don't have any postcode restrictions for those areas because of these natural disasters. So there can be situations where a valuer could go out to a property on a property that you've purchased and note that it is in a flood zone and is flood affected, and that can increase the lender's risk tolerance to lend, where they might ask for more capital or more a higher deposit to mitigate their risk. So that's really important to check when you are looking at properties in these areas, to have a chat with your broker or financier and just check if there's any postcode restrictions on any of these areas. Were there any specific sections of the suburb to avoid, just so you have that context going into it and avoid some of the sunk costs of having to buy a property and be stuck with it because you've waived your finance or having to rescind potentially as well.
That really is useful, having a good team that can do all of that for you, because I know, especially when I was investing, when I was living in Australia and investing more actively, being able to do that level of detailed research in a suburb that you might not be intimately familiar with, it's difficult. It's not easy. It's not easy to get all of that info and to be doing it over dozens of properties to make sure you get something that's really going to fit for you. In terms of insurance, since natural disasters are pretty much tied inextricably to insurance so that you can protect your asset, right? There are some insurance companies I've heard who are putting embargoes on particular suburbs or particular areas and saying, basically, we're not going to insure there, or if we do, the rate's going to be absolutely astronomical. One of the things I like about the free market is that the free market will normally find a solution for that. And I know that insurance isn't completely free, right? It does need to be regulated. But what are we kind of seeing in terms of free market solutions to that problem?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So we saw Sure Insurance come through, which is an insurance company that is specifically there to provide insurance in these far north Queensland areas, which traditionally either have higher insurance premiums from other providers or have embargoes where they won't insure at all. And they've seen that as a gap in the market and an attitude to essentially that everyone is entitled to insurance, which is I completely agree with. And they're in there to help fill that market because they have a more comprehensive understanding of how those areas are affected by these weather events, and as a result can adjust their risk preferences to suit a lower premium for clients looking to get insurance in those areas too.
Right. Okay. Well, speaking of natural disasters, we'll move to another type of disaster then. And this is probably the last big factor that a lot of people are worried about: the next pandemic. WEF, Bill Gates, people like that have made comments like, oh yes, we need to be prepared for the next pandemic, almost as though it's preordained, right? Or almost as though they know it's going to happen. And without jumping down any conspiracy rabbit holes, just to put people's minds at ease or to make sure that they are assessing that possibility objectively and intelligently, how do we kind of see things like the pandemic, if they were like the property market, what happened in the last property market with the pandemic? And would you say that if we have another one, the same thing's likely to happen?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And the main thing with the pandemic that I feel is consumer sentiment. So it does restrict people's willingness and ability to invest in the market because there's potentially fear, because this is obviously with the COVID pandemic, that was the first time that it happened for a while. And there was lockdowns and shutdowns and there were business closures and governments printing money. It looked like a recipe for disaster on the property front, but we actually saw significant growth in a lot of the areas that we bought for clients and in the property market as a whole, quite generally. So an interesting example is we had one of our clients purchase a property pretty much as the pandemic was starting, and they sold it in the last 6 months. And over that period, they made about a $200,000 gain by participating in a time where it was perceived that there was higher risk and there was lack of consumer sentiment because of the COVID pandemic, but they've actually been able to create a really favorable property result by actually taking action during that period, which is quite cool.
That story probably highlights the importance of not letting fear create indecision, because fear often does lead to indecision. People don't know what to do, and so you kind of make the default decision not to do anything. Let's just sit and wait for a little bit longer, and sort of, you know, you wait, the property goes up, the property market goes up, and a lot of people can get left behind. I think kind of in summary of all of the things that we've been talking about today then is there are a lot of factors that we talked about last week that look absolutely primed to make what I think, this is not financial advice, this is just Emil's prediction that everyone could look up in a year and see how close we got. 2024 and 2025 are going to be absolutely massive years for the property market. But we've now analyzed a bunch of factors that could start to temper that. We've looked at the rise of crypto, and I think that's largely irrelevant. We've looked at natural disasters, and looks like you can pretty much always mitigate something bad happening to your portfolio if you do your due diligence properly, and it doesn't really seem to be something that's going to hurt your portfolio. We've looked at pandemics, the results from those, and the importance of not being too fearful. The only thing that really kind of stands out is like this could be, it's a little bit of a tricky one, is the cost of living crisis. So with that in mind, I'm still going to stick with my initial prediction. I do think it's going to be a mess. I don't think the cost of living crisis can pull back the property market. I think it's going absolutely bananas over the course of the next couple of years. Nevertheless, we need to be thinking about portfolios and all of these factors that we've talked about in these two episodes. How do you see portfolios changing in the second half of 2024 and beyond?
It's a really interesting argument and really something cool that we can dig into here, because the main thing that we're seeing affecting our clients is cash flow. So we speak about the three constraints, right? The cash flow, capital, and credit, the three C's. A lot of what's restricting our clients from moving forward is cash flow, specifically in the sense of being able to manage their portfolio cash flow alongside their savings rate. So when we work with clients, one of the things we really want to understand is how much are you willing to contribute towards your property portfolio on an annual basis? And the reason for that is because a lot of the properties that we're buying in the current environment, I'd say 99%, are cash flow negative because of the high interest rates and also some of these higher costs that we've spoken about with insurance as well. But interest rates is the primary driver. So it's looking at how can we build a successful portfolio whilst managing those constraints. So it really like that becomes the main constraint with clients moving forward. Obviously, initially when clients move forward, the main constraint tends to be capital with saving that deposit. That can usually take a bit of time, or if you're using equity from a PPOR or another investment property, that can become easier. But sorry, go.
On that note about the capital, one thing that we did talk about last week was the easing of lending criteria and the amount of capital becoming much less. So I see that I would envisage that's going to become less of a constraint. And also people who are already in the property market, whether it's because they already own their own home or they have an investment property somewhere if they're investing, as the property prices go up, as the property market goes up, they're going to have more and more equity there. So I see capital as not, as almost, I won't say completely irrelevant, but it's going to be a pretty minor factor. There's going to be tons of lenders who are going to be able to provide credit.
I 100% agree. So the credit side of things is with all the loosening of lending criteria, that's definitely going to help. But when we see things like 97% LVRs, it does create a very high debt level and a very high cash flow that's needed to kind of balance that out. That's why cash flow is becoming a more present challenge, and specifically what our portfolio strategists are helping clients navigate through, because you could have someone, for example, that's got $300,000 of equity in a property that they can release and move forward. But by doing that, they're increasing the debt on another investment, which is going to increase their cash flow commitment. And if they don't have the cash flow to be able to manage that commitment and buy those two properties, they're going to create a situation where they won't be able to hold those properties for the long term and derive the benefit. So being able to manage,
So how does that affect asset selection from our end then? When we're trying to plan these portfolios for our clients, what sort of asset, is there any change to the types of assets we look at?
100%. The best way to start with this is by getting a portfolio growth plan. I know we've spoken about this quite specifically, but having a plan in the current environment is really important so you don't create an outcome that you can't go back from if you've made a mistake. So having a clear pathway forward is really important. So we understand with our clients coming on board, how much cash do they have? How much equity do they have? What is their savings rate? And having all those inputs in place, we can then decide what the best way is to move them forward in the current environment. So we can do that a few ways. Asset selection is definitely one way. And one of the ways that we've spoken about this more recently is incorporating units. into our clients' portfolios as more of a balanced approach to get the growth being in those really nice areas, but also having the higher rental yields to compensate in managing cash flow?
I think that is extremely important. And it's something that I, and just about everybody I know, when they started off their property investment journey, the mistake is not to have a plan. It's sort of like, oh, I'll buy one or two properties, and then I'll start thinking in more detail about what I need at that point, without realizing that those one or two properties that you start off with, the effect that those can have on your ability to borrow further down the track is absolutely massive. And I've spoken to our strategist, Andy Bernardos, on the podcast a few episodes back, a little while ago, and we went through like some of the things that people can do, some of those mistakes that you just kind of referenced, where if you get it wrong, if you get that first or second or third property wrong, suddenly 3 or 4 or 5 years down the track, you have a constraint that you cannot get past without selling some of your properties, and that's expensive. Right, in this current environment, it sounds like it's mostly going to be a cash flow constraint. But if you haven't planned for that and plotted it properly, then suddenly you end up locked up. And instead of it taking 5 or 10 or at the outside 15 years to reach your property goal, suddenly it's like 30, or you're never going to get there. And so I think that is absolutely critical.
Like 100%. Or you could even be in a worse situation than when you started. It's really important to have it's really important to have a plan when you move forward with this. And this is one of the things that our strategist will do, is looking at all your constraints. Because like some people might not have a cash flow constraint. That's just what we're seeing at the moment with a few of our clients. But some people might have a capital constraint or a borrowing capacity constraint. So it's really important to have a plan so we know, hey, what are the constraints that you're going to come across in your journey, and how can we help overcome for that? But majority we're seeing clients is cash flow, specifically because the properties that we are purchasing, and majority of the properties in the current environment are that negative cash flow situation. So asset selection, definitely one way. Another way is looking at value adds. So specifically renovate for yield style value adds. And this is something that we talk to all of our clients about, not as like a mandatory, but just checking about their openness to accept a property that could have a cosmetic renovation value add. And the reason for that is spending the additional money to also then increase the rent, which is going to help you manage those negative cash flow constraints. So that's one. Renovations can also have capital uplifts as well, depending on what those specific projects are. We've done a really cool podcast on how to increase cash flow in your portfolio that people can check out if they want to get some more insight on that. But value adds is a really cool one that we look at. And then there's a few others that we rely primarily on some of the partners that we work with. So looking at how can you structure your portfolio for success to mitigate your negative cash flow impact. So making sure you have a really good accountant on side to navigate that through, and also looking at when purchasing properties, most of the time the highest ROI through property is using debt. So looking at how can you structure your debt in a way that's going to be optimized for the current cash flow position and being able to set your portfolio up to hold those properties for the long term. Those are the main ones that I saw to kind of navigate cash flow constraints that we look at holistically, and we assign to our clients depending on when they need that in their portfolio and obviously what their risk tolerance is as well.
All right. If I'm to try to provide an analogy for this, I really want to stress the importance of having a plan, because if you're going to have a portfolio and it's going to have four properties in it, property A, property B, property C, property D, and you buy them in that order, A, then B, you might get stuck on C. You might not be able to buy C for an extra 5 or 10 years. But if you buy them in the order B, C, A, D, you might be able to go through there completely fine. You're still ending up with the same number of properties, but it's the time that it takes. And it's almost like with accounting, you might earn a salary of this, have investments of this. If you structure it in this particular way that the accountant says, then you pay this much tax. If you structure it in this different way that the accountant says, you pay this much tax. And they're different, right? There's a clear difference in those two structures. You've earned the same amount of money, but if you give stuff different names, you end up paying a completely different amount of tax. If you buy properties in a different order, you end up being able to acquire them in a completely different way and with completely different cash flow constraints and all of that sort of thing. So the message I think that this is something that I've really, it's been a real epiphany for me over the course of the last 8 months, the importance of having that plan. If you're a property expert, get a plan. If you have done property developments yourself, get a plan. If you've been studying every property in your neighborhood or a specific suburb, just get a plan. Whatever you do, get a plan. Maybe from us, we're pretty good at it. We do very, very in-depth portfolio growth plans. But you know, you can talk to a mortgage broker, you can talk to accountants, you can talk to a lot of different people, but get a plan. If you don't have a plan, you're like one of those people who's trying to do rock climbing and they haven't actually plotted the route. They're just sitting at the bottom. They're going, oh, which ones are we doing? Oh, we're doing the yellow ones. All right. And they just grab the first yellow one and they get about halfway up the wall and then they're stuck and they're thinking, oh, well, that foot's in the wrong place and that hand's not going anywhere. So I guess I have to crawl all the way back to the bottom. And what you don't want to be doing when it's your property portfolio is crawling all the way back to the bottom. Another key topic that I want to ask you about is all of these factors that we're talking about in this podcast and the one last week, that's affecting people's portfolios. It's affecting people's property, their portfolio growth plans as well. It's affecting a lot of different things. How does rentvesting, something we've talked about a lot on this podcast, but not yet in this episode, how is rentvesting sort of coming into the picture?
Yeah, rentvesting is a really cool concept. And I heard your podcast with Callum, by the way. I thought that was pretty awesome. Looking at how rentvesting can help from a borrowing front, but it can actually help resolve a lot of these constraints, looking at cash flow, capital, and credit. So from a cash flow perspective, renting, traditionally, you'll be paying less money than owning your own home. So you will have a larger surplus of cash that you can put towards your portfolio. Traditionally as well, I read a really interesting stat is when you rentvest, you can actually rent something three times better than what you can afford to buy, assuming the same amount of rent. So even from a lifestyle perspective, you end up likely in a better position in a house that you probably like a little bit more than if you owned it. Looking at capital, I know you spoke about this, looking at credit, I know you spoke about this with Callum as well, but when you do rent, the bank will take your rental repayments at face value. So from a borrowing perspective, it can work in your favor, as opposed to having a mortgage where there's buffers being added that affect your serviceability. And even from a capital perspective, renting will save you more money. So it'll affect your ability to generate capital more quickly to put towards your property portfolio as well. And from a credit perspective, buying your own home is usually a purchase that goes in your personal name for the most part, and that will immediately affect your ability to borrow. It can sometimes, depending on your borrowing capacity, completely hamstring your investment journey before you even get it started.
Right. So to put that into sort of real numbers for people, because I did do that podcast with Callum, who is incredibly switched on, by the way. We're very fortunate that we've got really good partners, and I've done podcasts with three mortgage brokers over the course of the last 6 months. We've had Onar Serrano on, we've had Stephen McClatchy, and now Callum Rhodes as well, and they're all absolutely fantastic. One of the things, when we break down the numbers, it could be that if you own your own property, it might be costing you $700 a week in mortgage repayments, but then the lender, which may well be the bank, when you're looking to buy your next property, they might assess that at $1,100. Or at $1,200. And so that means that, A, you've got $700 of dead mortgage repayments. But B, you're now being assessed at having $1,100 or $1,200 worth of mortgage repayments. If you rent, you could rent somewhere for $600 or $650 that will be better than the house you can be living in and paying mortgage repayments at $700. Which means you can save an extra $50 a week or maybe more, you know, depending on the property. Because also you don't have to worry about upkeep. You don't have to worry about maintenance. And that will actually get assessed at $600 or $650. It won't get assessed at $1,200. And so if cash flow is the main constraint, this is a really good way of making your cash flow numbers look an absolute ton better for the lender. And that's why that's the importance of if your dream is to own properties A, B, C, and D, and if A is your personal, your principal place of residence, that can really hamper your ability to get B. Or if you get B, it can really hamper your ability to get C. Whereas if you buy B, C, D, and then A, it's entirely possible that you get there a lot faster. And buying B first as an investment property means it's probably a better investment choice. And it also means that you're getting to live in another property, right, that we haven't even given a letter yet. And that might be a way better lifestyle for you that's a little bit cheaper. So that's kind of in a nutshell why rentvesting is becoming so popular. We see so many people kind of shifting to it and getting rid of this kind of preconceived idea that the first property you buy must be the one that you're going to live in. that's now starting to feel like it's a very, very outdated way of thinking about property investment.
Yeah, we're even seeing, like, just on this as well, like, housing obviously is the biggest expense that most people will have. So being able to mitigate that through rent vesting will be useful for your investment journey. But we're also seeing more people living at home longer, which is meaning their living expenses are virtually zero. And from a lending perspective, a lot of banks will take like a notional rent. It's like $650 for living expenses if you live at home. But now I just read an interesting article today, actually, where there is a bank that won't even include the $650 in your servicing. So if you live at home, you can literally have zero living expense. Obviously, you're paying $0 living expense if your parents are happy with that, obviously. You're mitigating your constraints. And also, there are some lenders that are not looking at the $650 that gets included. So your borrowing capacity, again, gets supercharged by additional $650 a month. So there's a lot of benefits in looking at creative ways to reduce your living expenses to help you scale your portfolio. There's a really good synergy there.
All righty. Well, I think the key message that I'm definitely getting out of this episode is there are a bunch of factors out there that we talked about last week that make the market absolutely primed for massive growth. There are a few factors that we've looked at today that a lot of people are fearful of, that they don't necessarily need to be fearful of, but we do have the cost of living crisis. And when we're looking at how that's going to affect property portfolios, a key constraint that people are probably going to be running up against pretty soon is going to be cash flow. So whatever you can do to improve your cash flow situation is really, really going to help you get into the property market and really, really thrive through and take advantage of all the growth that we're expecting for the rest of this year and next year. We haven't talked about any potential World War III. We haven't talked about any like absolute black swan events that could completely just destroy everything, right? We haven't gone so far as to think about, well, you know, what if a solar flare just, you know, pops through the entire earth and kills us all? We haven't gone that far, but obviously World War III would not be great. But everything that we can sort of practically foresee, I think we've had a look at. We've tried really hard to steel man this argument and find things that might dampen the property market and sort of rain on everyone's party. But in this environment, it's really tough to find the negatives. It really, really is. So on that note, thank you very much, Jason. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I'm hoping that we get to see you on here again pretty soon.
Awesome. Thanks, Neil. It was fun.